This audio was recorded October 2009 and is of a WSM meeting in Dublin on South African social struggles. The speaker is Jonathan from the Zablaza Anarchist Communist Front. You'll find more audio at the WSM website at www.wsm.ie.
Okay, I think we can begin. Hello and welcome to this talk hosted by the Workers' Solidarity Movement. This evening with the speaker, Jonathan here, is from South African group, Zablaza Anarchist Communist Federation. Zablaza is an anarchist organisation in the same tradition as the WSM, and it is our pleasure to host them here this evening. Zablaza was formed on the 1st of May 2003 with a combination of a number of organisations, including the Bekisha Media Collective, Zablaza Books, Anarchist Black Cross, the Zablaza Action Group, and also a number of individual militants across South Africa. Zablaza has been active during a period of significant interest and growth in anarchist politics in South Africa, and in particular following the collapse of the former USSR and the subsequent fall of apartheid, a new space has been opened up for anarchism in South Africa. While the end of apartheid ended state-supported and facilitated legal, economic and political racism, the African National Congress has merely overseen the removal of overt racial laws but focuses on courting big business and ignoring the needs of the working class. The ANC has proven itself to have less than working class friendly politics, and has since gaining power in 1994 imposed neoliberal reforms that have even surprised the IMF and the World Bank. This has ensured that while the discrimination against people along racial lines has changed in South Africa, the black working class majority still remains in less poverty. It's within this context that Zablaza has found expression within the ranks of the working class, and Zablaza is following in the footsteps of anarchist organising on the continent, which started over a century ago. Today they're part of the worldwide growth in anarchism, which is gaining momentum after the demise of authoritarian socialism. Jonathan is going to speak in particular on the historical context of anarchist organising in South Africa and contemporary social struggles there. Alan is going to give a brief introduction to the WSM, but it is with great pleasure that we welcome Jonathan and Zablaza here today.
Okay, thank you all for coming. I guess there's two points to my being here today. The one is to dispel some of the illusions that exist around the so-called liberation of South Africa and the transition from white minority rule to majority government and bourgeois democracy. The other being to try and drum up some solidarity and support for contemporary social struggles and against the repression that they face. On Saturday night, 26th of September this year, at around 11:30 in the evening, a group of somewhere between 30 and 40 armed men entered into a settlement, an informal shack settlement by the name of Kennedy Road, and proceeded to destroy the shacks of somewhere between 15 and 30 shacks of members, activist members of an organization known as Abakhlali Basim Jondolo, the Shack Dwellers Movement. Abakhlali was having a public meeting at the time when they realized that their shacks were being destroyed, and that there was a chance that this gang of armed men was going to attack them. They called the police, asking for the police to intervene to prevent further shacks from being destroyed and to protect them. They were told by the police that they didn't have the resources, that it being a Saturday night, you know, all of the patrol cars and whatnot were elsewhere dealing with other cases. Never mind the fact that when Abakhlali is mobilizing in protest, the police will be there in a matter of minutes with water cannons and helicopters and so on. A gang of armed men proceeded to attack the meeting. They killed, three people were reportedly killed by the armed gang, which was carrying things like machetes, firearms, clubs, and even a sword. A few people died later in hospital. Two of the attackers were reportedly killed in self-defense, not necessarily by people associated with Abakhlali, but by community members that came to the defense of their fellow community members. The next day at around midday, the police arrived in the settlement together with local ANC leaders. and proceeded to arrest 8 people from the Kennedy Road Development Committee, which is the Abu Khlali affiliate in that area. They were charged with, amongst other things, murder and denied bail. In the days that followed, or days and weeks that followed that, another 5 to 7 people were arrested in Kennedy Road and in neighboring informal settlements. One person even being arrested in rural Eastern Cape, which is a good couple of hours' drive from Kennedy Road. They were all denied bail and are currently facing murder charges and others at the Westbury prison in KwaZulu-Natal. In the wake of the attacks, somewhere in the region of 1,000 people, Abu Khlali members and their families, fled the settlement for fear of their lives and were told by the gang never to return on pain of death. Essentially what has happened now is that Kennedy Road has been occupied by an arm of ganged thugs. As it transpires, the attack was orchestrated by local members of the ANC branch in Kennedy Road and neighboring informal settlements. It's not clear how high this goes in the ANC, if it's a local thing or if high-ranking ANC officials nationally knew about the attacks. It's also not clear what kind of police involvement there was. We suspect that either the police knew about the attacks before they happened and decided to sit back and allow them to carry on, or quite possibly that the police superintendent of the local police station was involved in orchestrating the attacks. He, together with the branch executive of the local ANC, have publicly stated that they would crush Abu Khlali and that the Abu Khlali office would be turned into an ANC branch office before the end of the year. So these are clearly orchestrated attacks that recall the state-sponsored terror of the 1980s. Since then, the government, ANC, and the police have been waging a media campaign against Abu Khlali, painting them as a criminal organization and an anti-democratic organization, and basically placidly endorsing the attacks. None of the people that were involved in the attacks have been arrested. When the Abu Khlali members, the now 13 Abu Khlali members, appeared in court for a hearing, the ANC bussed in 2 busloads of supporters demanding that they be denied bail and threatening Abu Khlali supporters that came there in defense of their comrades. Saying such things as when they entered the Kennedy Road settlement, they had the intention of killing Abu Khlali leader Sibu Sikode and other Abu Khlali members. And this is one of the most significant social and political events to take place in contemporary South African history or society, and it has potentially grave and far-reaching implications for the popular classes and for South African society as a whole. In order to properly understand the context in which these attacks took place and possible responses to it, I think it's necessary to go back a little further in radical South African history just to set the scene. So I'm going to go back about 100 years, slightly more, to the early syndicalist and anarcho-syndicalist history in South Africa. Anarchism as an ideology first came to South Africa in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when European workers, European anarchist and syndicalist workers, went to South Africa to look for jobs in the mines and in the docks and so on. A lot of workers from Ireland and Scotland, England and other countries, Portugal and so on. And they took with them the ideas of revolutionary syndicalism or anarcho-syndicalism. They established the first multiracial trade unions and multiracial political organizations in South Africa, such as the Industrial Workers of Africa, which was modeled on the Industrial Workers of the World. They set up an Industrial Workers of the World branch. Organizations such as the International Socialist League and Industrial Socialist League were all formed by revolutionary or anarcho-syndicalists in the 1910s. The first Communist Party of South Africa was formed by revolutionary syndicalists in the 1920s. It was explicitly extra-parliamentarian, believing that that communism or socialism could not be reached through parliamentary action, but by the direct action and struggle of the organized working class. It was explicitly internationalist, believing that in order to overthrow imperialism, capitalism, institute, communist society, you needed to organize beyond borders, that the working class was international and that its struggles needed to be international. A year later, in 1921, the Parliamentarian Communist Party of South Africa International was formed, which was allied to the Comintern and adopted Lenin's 21 points of, I forget the official name, Lenin's 21 points of how to screw the working class. It was of fundamental importance to many people at the time was the national question, and the CPSA International adopted Lenin's Native Republic thesis in 1928. Tensions between the syndicalist tradition and the Bolshevization of the party led to the syndicalists being purged in the 1920s, and the first wave of libertarian or syndicalist militancy went into decline with the growing Bolshevik influence. In the 1940s, under the direct instruction of the Comintern, the Communist Party of South Africa allied itself to the African National Congress, which was identified as the primary party of national liberation. The CPSA was then banned in 1950 and reestablished itself as the South African Communist Party underground. The SACP and the CPSA before that were far bigger than the African National Congress. But when SACP went underground, it threw its weight behind the African National Congress and played a big role in organizing the Defiance Campaign and other campaigns of the ANC. And people such as Nelson Mandela and Walter Sisulu were very conscious that they were using the SACP as a kind of recruiting ground and mobilizing ground for the ANC. Although the ANC was never socialist, never claimed socialism, it did use socialist rhetoric to gain popular support. The SACP, however, tied itself to the ANC because of the two-stage theory of national democratic revolution that the ANC embraced, which was essentially that before you could reach socialism, you needed to institute a majority government, a bourgeois democracy, either through means of armed struggle, mass struggle, or parliamentary action, and only after that could you proceed to socialism. The ANC never had any intention of proceeding to the second phase of the National Democratic Revolution, but it used that rhetoric in order to gain the support of the working class and of the SACP. In fact, the former president, Nelson Mandela, said in 1956, when the ANC drew up the Freedom Charter, that the aim of the ANC was to create a black bourgeoisie that could own land, factories, and mines in its own right and would flourish as never before, flourish and prosper as never before. During the 1970s and 1980s, you had a massive escalation of worker militancy and community and student struggles and militancy in the struggle against apartheid. In 1973, you had the Durban strikes, and in 1976, the Soweto student uprising, which in a matter of hours had spread across the country. It is important to note at this point that the ANC had virtually no influence in the popular struggles of the black working class. It was a minority party. In 1979, the Federation of South African Trade Unions was formed. It was criticized by the ANC and by the authoritarian left as being a workerist tendency. It was far more democratic than the Congress of South African Trade Unions, but did not have clear enough politics and failed to properly resist the backsliding of the ANC alliance and decayed over time. FASATU then merges with the Congress of South African Trade Unions when it was formed in 1985 and 2 years later allied itself to the ANC, becoming more authoritarian over time, and which ultimately led to the general demobilization of workers' struggles leading up to the 1994 democratic elections. COSATU, as with the SACP, endorses the ANC's policy of two-phase national democratic revolution and nationalism, lending itself to the leadership being co-opted into the ruling class post-1994. The United Democratic Front was formed in 1983, leading to the upsurge of community and civic organization and resistance, culminating in mass insurrections beginning in 1984. Again, the ANC had very little influence within the UDF at the time. At the end of the 1980s, due to an increase in influence of the ANC, the UDF becomes increasingly more centralized, which paves the way for the disbanding of the civic movement in 1991 at the first Congress of the ANC after its disbanding. So one of the first public acts of the ANC after it came in, after it was unbanned, was to dissolve the mass civic organizations and community organizations, which were basically the backbone of the struggle against apartheid. So just prior to that, basically what you have is a potentially revolutionary situation where you have a huge and militant organized working class involved in all kinds of industrial actions and strikes, as well as very radical and militant student and civic or community-based movement, which had the potential of possibly overthrowing the apartheid state. In the 1970s, the South African economy went into a bit of a boom, but the economy of the apartheid economy was primarily an extractive economy based on the super exploitation of the black working class. It thrived on basically paying the black working class very, very low wages in the mining and extractive industry. It began to reach a crisis where, because of the sanctions that were imposed on the economy, it couldn't export raw materials internationally. It didn't have access to international markets. At the same time as that, it couldn't develop internal markets in manufacturing and so on because of the low wages of the black working class and the fact that and the unskilled labor. The working class didn't have the skills to go into manufacturing, to produce manufactured goods. And even if they could, there was an internal market to sell them because people just didn't have the wages to, you know, didn't have the buying power to be able to buy items like kettles and fridges and so on. So these two factors, that the economy was in decline and the sort of mass insurrectionary workers movement, led the white capitalist class to realize that in order to basically save capital from potential revolution or implosion, it was necessary for them to enter into negotiations and to try and negotiate a transition from white minority rule to a black bourgeois democracy in order to open up in external markets and as well as develop a more skilled working class that could earn slightly better wages and have access to locally manufactured goods. So what you have is that the ANC and the apartheid intelligence enter into secret negotiations in the 1980s. In 1990, Nelson Mandela is approached while he's in prison on Robben Island by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, seeking a solution to reinvigorate the economy and to negotiate a transition from white minority rule. In 1987, amongst others, Thabo Mbeki and current President Jacob Zuma enter into negotiations with apartheid intelligence agencies, Afrikaner nationalist intellectuals, and white capital. In 1993, the ANC signs an informal structural adjustment agreement with the International Monetary Fund, and in 1994 is elected into government in the first multiracial democratic elections. It immediately begins implementing a neoliberal economic policies, which are basically a perfect continuity of the economic policies that were begun under the nationalist regime of apartheid, which were begun under President Botha with privatization of Sasol, which is the state-owned oil company that sort of converts coal into petrol, and ISCOR, which was a state-owned steel company. So the ANC begins to implement policies of neoliberalism, cost recovery, privatization, cuts in social spending, retrenchments, outsourcing, and so on. Some of the things that have been happening all around the world around the same time. Instead of creating 1 million jobs, which the ANC promised in its election manifesto leading up to 1994, in the first 10 years of its rule, 1 million people were retrenched or lost their jobs as a result of privatization. Cuts in social spending led to sort of a decline in access to education, to health care, and so on. In 1999, the municipal workers went out on strike against privatization and retrenchments, which was one of the the first big strikes post-apartheid. Basically, the state was privatizing municipal services such as trash collection and so on. Around the same time, in July 2000, the Anti-Privatization Forum was launched at Wits University against the privatization of services at the Wits University campus, things like ground staff, security, catering, and so on, which were being privatized at the time. It included the South African Communist Party and some Kasatu unions, both of which had to pull out on the orders of the ANC a little while later, and those that remained were expelled from the SACP and ANC. In 2001, the APF emerged as a federation of community organizations, alongside other new social movements such as the anti-eviction campaign and landless people's movement, which were, as with the APF, basically single-issue social movements or campaigns that were fighting against the eviction of people in the Cape Flats, fighting against privatization, and so on, which, being single-issue, primarily single-issue driven movements, had the strengths and weaknesses of this. On the one hand, it was easy for them to mobilize communities around things like privatization of electricity cuts, water cutoffs, and so on. At the same time, however, it could also lead to mass demobilization of these social movements if they won or lost those struggles, or if they moved on to different terrain. Direct action movements such as Operation Kanyisa, which means Operation Light, were started in Chatsworth, in KwaZulu-Natal, and in Soweto, where people began to illegally reconnect electricity after it had been cut off. One of the tactics of non-white working class people during the struggle, towards the end of the struggle against apartheid, was to refuse to pay for electricity to the state-owned electricity company, sort of under the assumption that when the apartheid regime was overthrown, those areas would be scrapped by a majority government. As it happens, those areas weren't scrapped, and thousands upon thousands of communities' electricity was cut off because they couldn't afford to pay the arrears for the electricity they'd used over the years. So they embarked on this campaign to reconnect houses to their electricity, which was successful in that the Eskom did eventually scrap the arrears after thousands of households had been reconnected, but said that, you know, we'll scrap your arrears, but you have to pay for electricity per unit from now on. Likewise, there were direct action campaigns to bypass water meters, and so on. Having won some important battles using both legal and direct action tactics, some of these campaigns went into decline. As has recently happened with the Anti-Privatization Forum and one of its initiatives called the Coalition Against Water Privatization, which was struggling against the installation of prepaid water meters, which basically meant that the private water provider would install a meter at your household, and in order to have access to water, you had to pay up front. You would get kind of like a debit card with a little electronic tag, and you'd have to pay for water before you could use it, then swipe the tag, and that would unlock the pump, and you could turn your taps on. What happened, though, is that people didn't, you know, they couldn't afford to pay for a month's supply of water, so they would have water for the first week or two, and then they wouldn't have any water, leading to, in Soweto, two children being burned to death in their shack when their shack caught on fire, and no one in the community, in the neighboring community, had any credit on their water tags, and so they couldn't turn on the taps to put out the fire, and these children burned to death. And similar things happened and continue to happen throughout the country. So they embarked on a campaign to bypass these meters or to destroy these meters, and in some massive protests to return those meters to the Johannesburg councillor. They also took the state and the private water provider to court, saying that it's unconstitutional. You know, the Constitution guarantees the right to life and the right to water, and it's unconstitutional for people to have to pay in advance for water. This case was recently lost at the Constitutional Court, which has kind of led to a demobilization of the Anti-Privatization Forum and the Coalition Against Water Privatization, although there's a possibility that they'll carry on with the direct action campaign. Within these social movements, there's also being an ongoing battle of ideas between the sort of authoritarian left, which is trying to turn these social movements into political parties that could contest local or national elections and basically get members of these authoritarian organizations elected as onto the local council. And on the other hand, between anarchists and libertarians of different stripes who have challenged these attempts to reconstitute social movements as political organizations. At the moment, the anti-electoral tendency has gained the upper hand over the last couple of years, but it might be that this is kind of more based on a tactical alliance between people who take a principled positions against competing in elections and people who see it more as a tactical question and think that now is not the right time, that social movements are not strong enough to contest with any success. As a response to the emergence of these new social movements beginning with in 1999, 2000, there's been an increasing level of state repression. The state has used all kinds of means to try and break the backbone of these new social movements, including using apartheid-era legislation such as the Illegal Gatherings Act, which was implemented by the apartheid regime to prevent people from meeting, and black people from meeting, non-whites, and organizing. Which it basically says that any gathering of more than any public gathering of more than 15 people is an illegal gathering, and you need to get state permission to have a meeting of more than 15 people, meaning that this would be deemed an illegal gathering and could be broken up by the police. Now, the state still uses this legislation sometimes, and especially when social movements have protests, have spontaneous protests, community protests, they'll disrupt protests and arrest people in the Gatherings Act. Part of their strategy being to break the social movements financially. So they arrest a bunch of people and then release them on bail and drop the charges, but the social movements have to come up with the bail, which sort of cripples them financially or have to pay for lawyers and so on. It's also used more sinister means of repression, arresting people. There was a case in 1999, I think it was, where the Landless People's Movement was staging a no-land, no-vote protest outside an election booth during national elections. The police arrested a bunch of activists and proceeded to tear gas them in the police cell. The state has also implemented a new initiative called the Community Policing Forums, which are supposed to be, they say that they're attempts to integrate communities, community members into policing their own communities, you know, to keep them safe. But what they really are is kind of an appendage of the ANC that is used to spy on and inform against social movements activists, and it attracts the most conservative elements of these communities. And in fact, over the last couple of years, these CPFs have been involved in the murder of Anti-Privatization Forum and other social movements activists. This year, there was the third, I think, national elections since apartheid was overthrown, or since the transition from apartheid to bourgeois democracy. And a person by the name of Jacob Zuma was elected the new president. He's the president of the African National Congress. He's openly patriarchal and homophobic, and he's a Zulu nationalist, a conservative, a traditionalist. And basically, in tandem with his rise to prominence and with his election campaign, there's been an escalation in chauvinistic violence and chauvinistic attitudes within working class and poor communities, which has led in some cases to attacks on immigrants and to attacks on gays and lesbians, particularly working-class black lesbians. And although the ANC doesn't blatantly promote or encourage this kind of attitude, the views expressed by Zuma have allowed these sentiments to establish themselves and to be fermented within the popular classes. And the ANC has kind of placidly endorsed these sentiments, even when they've turned into violent actions against women and immigrants and so on, because they essentially suit the interests of the ruling class and do the dirty work of the state without the state having to get its hands bloodied. For example, it creates a very dangerous perception as supporters of Jacob Zuma, like the ANC Youth League president, have said that now is the time for the Zulus. You know, now is the time for man to reassert himself. Now is the time for us to sweep back the what we see as progressive gains, such as gay and lesbian marriage, abortion rights, and so on, by this sort of conservative wing within the class. To this end, Jacob Zuma has been building and continues to build and forge links with right-wing churches during and after the election campaign. And it creates a very dangerous situation where legitimate discontent of the popular classes can easily be misdirected against convenient scapegoats, such as immigrants or gays and lesbians. Thus, these legitimate grievances of service delivery, a lack of service delivery, unemployment due to neoliberal economic system and policies, and so on, are redirected against immigrants who are accused of stealing jobs, of houses, and so on, which is what happened last year when a community in an informal settlement called Alexandra in Johannesburg met to protest against lack of service delivery or lack of delivery of houses. What happened is that local political leaders from the ANC and also from Inkatha channeled this frustration that was being expressed at this meeting and scapegoated immigrants. They blamed immigrants for stealing the houses that were supposed to be provided to South Africans and for stealing jobs and so on. And the community went on the rampage and attacked immigrants within the community and destroyed their homes and so on. And this this pogrom spread within a couple of days to poor communities across the country. It lasted a couple of weeks, and in the end, somewhere in the region of 60 people, mostly immigrants, but not only, were killed, and hundreds of thousands fled the community, fled the country. And basically, the state was warned by the National Intelligence Agency as early as January last year. These attacks commenced in May, I think, that if the state didn't intervene and do something to quell the sort of rising xenophobic attitudes and chauvinistic attitudes within poor communities, that something like this would very likely take place. The state didn't do anything, and when the attacks, it was very slow to respond to these attacks, you know, to go into communities and to try and prevent violence and destruction to property and so on. And when it did intervene, what it did was adopt a policy of voluntary repatriation, whereby they basically said that if you stay in South Africa, you're going to get killed. We can't guarantee your protection. So we'll pay to bus you by the thousand back to the countries from which you came from. And so it's very clear that the xenophobic pogroms and this increase of chauvinistic attitude served the interests of the state and of the ruling class, in that it gave them an excuse to repatriate hundreds of thousands of immigrants to the country, from neighboring countries, you know, from Zimbabwe and war-torn countries such as the Congo and whatnot. And in this respect, Abakhlali Basumjondolo and the Shack Dwellers movement in Durban became a victim of their own prediction. When the xenophobic pogroms took place last year, they released a public statement in which they said that if today these attacks are being perpetrated against immigrants, non-nationals, to the country, tomorrow it would be inter-ethnic conflict between different ethnic groups from South Africa, which is exactly what happened. When this, what is essentially a death squad, entered into Kennedy Road and attacked Abakhlali, they were chanting slogans such as, Kennedy Road is full of Zulu and Abakhlali is taking over Kennedy Road. Traditionally, KwaZulu-Natal, the province where Abakhlali is based, is a Zulu stronghold. The Zulu ethnic group is in the majority. And it has traditionally been a stronghold of the Inkatha Freedom Party, which is a political rival to the African National Congress. The African National Congress traditionally has been dominated by the people of the Xhosa ethnic group, and its leaders have always been of Xhosa origin. Jacob Zuma is the first Zulu to be an ANC president. And as part of his election campaign, they were playing on this ethnic card and this ethnic sentiment in order to canvass for the Zulu vote in what had traditionally been an Inkatha stronghold. As a result of this, Abahlali identified an increase in ethnic tensions in communities around where they were based in KwaZulu-Natal. And one of the things that they did is that in Kennedy Road, Abahlali has created a popular committee that has been charged by the community with sort of guaranteeing safety and security within the community. They have annual elections every year, whereby the next one was going to be in November, whereby the community can vote people onto this committee, which is charged with sort of protecting the community. One of the things that they did in the wake of Jacob Zuma's election campaign was implement a curfew on shebeens. Shebeen actually is a word that comes from Ireland, so you should all know what it means. Most people don't. They implemented a 10 o'clock curfew because they associated sort of drunkenness and late and excessive alcohol consumption in the late hours of the evening and early morning with ethnic tensions and violence that was taking place in the community, as well as sort of general antisocial behavior, domestic violence and whatnot. Most of the community was reportedly in support of this curfew. The only people that really had a problem with it being A, the Shebeen owners who lost money, and B, being the local political elite, the ANC, who don't like to see the working class communities taking control of their own lives and implementing things that are supposed to be under the control of the state. So what we and Abahlali believe is that as Abahlali was gaining influence, taking influence away from the ANC and away from the state, sort of being in charge of guaranteeing security within the community when the police are traditionally supposed to do such things, they orchestrated these attacks in order to break the backbone of Abahlali and sort of return power to the local political elite, to the ANC and to the police. As I'm sure you'll know, next year South Africa will be hosting the FIFA Football World Cup, and one of the policies that the government has been implementing is a policy of gentrification, whereby they try to clear the city centres and neighbouring areas from undesirables, from homeless, from vagrants, shack dwellers, and so on, and kind of basically dump them out of sight of where people would be expected to go during the Football World Cup. Abahlali has been quite successfully campaigning against this and challenging the state's an act that the state has been trying to implement called the Slums Act, which is exactly that, an act that is to sort of legalize this gentrification, and which would mean that hundreds of thousands of shack dwellers and people from informal settlements would be relocated to what they call temporary transit camps, very often miles away from where they have established themselves, where their children go to school, where they have jobs, or where the rest of their family and friends live. And it seems very clear that these attacks were orchestrated in order to break Abahlali so that they could pass this act and carry out the gentrification ahead of the Football World Cup. And we believe that there's a very real threat that if the perpetrators of these attacks and the state and the local ANC get away with these attacks, that they'll use it as a precedent and implement similar kinds of things, carry out similar kinds of actions in other areas where the social movements that might want to use the 2010 World Cup as a kind of a mobilizing tool and campaign against it, and try to maybe attract media attention and whatnot to their plight during the Football World Cup. So yeah, this is what I was saying, is that it presents a very grave danger to social movements and working class organization. Yeah, which is why we basically want to try and drum up some support. The 13 people that have been arrested are facing charges of, amongst others, murder, and we would like to try and raise some money. They're going to have an ongoing legal battle, and also for the 1,000-odd people that fled their communities, that need to rebuild themselves, reestablish their lives elsewhere, that have lost a lot of their possessions and so on. One other thing that I think is important in this context is the global economic crisis and the recession. which has hit South Africa quite hard, and I'm sure it has hit Ireland hard as well. It's kind of provided a convenient excuse for the Jacob Zuma administration, who, as politicians always do, made a whole bunch of promises during their election campaign, you know, that they would provide jobs and houses and access to healthcare and education and electricity and so on. And although they never, I believe, never had the intention to do this, kind of use the economic crisis as an excuse and say, you know, we wanted to, but we can't because of the economic crisis, which has led to hundreds of thousands of people being losing their jobs, being retrenched primarily in the mining sector and in manufacturing. As a result of this, with the increased unemployment, as well as the fact that a lot of people had faith in Jacob Zuma and believed that, you know, his intentions were good and all they needed to do was attract his attention and, you know, his administration would provide. There's been an escalation in community-based revolts and strikes over the last couple of months, which I don't know if they made the media here. There's been some quite big strikes and community revolts, which don't really go to the heart of the causes of, the unemployment and lack of service delivery and so on. And I see more and more as sort of struggles to maybe replace one corrupt councillor with another councillor, either from the ANC or from another political party. They don't challenge the economic policies of the ANC or such, but do sort of present an opportunity for social movements to try and engage with these communities and struggle and try to sort of provide a better analysis of what's going on, of the root causes of their struggles, and draw them into the ranks of social movements. There is opportunity for working class organization independent of political parties. At the same time, there's a very real threat that these legitimate grievances and frustration can be misdirected back at the popular classes and vulnerable elements. Anyone has questions or answers? Or...
Okay, if anyone has any questions, we'll take them from the floor.
This audio was recorded October 2009 and is of a WSM meeting in Dublin on South African social struggles. The speaker is Jonathan from the Zablaza Anarchist Communist Front. You'll find more audio at the WSM website at www.wsm.ie.